Today on Straight Talk Africa, we look at the girl-child marriage and its social and economic implications for Africa. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing the culture and effect of child marriage. 12 million girls get married every year by age 18, according to UNICEF. It happens worldwide, and girls suffer the consequences. VOA's Jessamyn Oni has more in this report on child brides.
11-year-old Bobogai went from selling firewood and paper to becoming a wife so she could settle her mother's debt.
I was crying. I wanted someone to help, but we had no choice. The lenders were pressing hard.
More than 12 million underage girls like her get married every year, according to UNICEF.
I had not begun menstruating when I married. I started in my husband's house.
Some girls entering into early marriages are under pressure to continue cultural traditions. Others say they had limited options.
I married my daughter off because we had no place to live. Where could I keep her? If I was in a house with her, if I had my own house like now, of course I would have sent her to school. She would not have needed to marry at 11, 12, or 13. She could have been educated, found a job, or learned a trade.
Early marriages happen across societies. In the U.S., most states permit marriage before 18 if the individuals meet certain criteria. However, critics say many of these marriages take place to circumvent statutory rape laws that protect minors.
I met him about when I was like 13, 14. So one thing after another, after a few years, we just kind of ended up together. I got pregnant underage, and that was kind of what had us go ahead and get married so I wouldn't send him to jail.
The young wives are more likely to leave school, experience domestic abuse, and live in poverty compared to those who marry later, according to human rights activists.
I lost my childhood. I loved school and going to school. But they wouldn't let me.
As governments face international pressure to take action, individuals and groups are stepping forward to help young girls.
The night before the wedding, a local official came to our house to ask whether I wanted to marry. When I said no, he halted the ceremony.
Sultan Tumadam found joy in her married life, despite being forced into the union.
I had never met my husband. I didn't know him. With time, we got to know each other. I'm very happy now. Thank goodness.
But the case was different for many of the child brides VOA met over the course of this project. Now divorced or deserted, they are angry at losing their education.
I think if I had only continued my studies, I would not have to experience so much harassment from other people now. I could have found a good job.
Now mothers themselves, they say they regret their stolen childhoods and add they never want to see their children married young.
I am now fighting for my children so they don't end up like me. Someone has to fight for them.
The United Nations is trying to eliminate the practice by 2030. Jason Samelny, VOA News.
Thanks, Jesse, for that report. Joining us here in our studio, we have our distinguished guest, Aisha Mwazu, a reporter with VOA's House of Service. And from our studios in New York, we are joined by Nyon Susan Sebit, human rights advocate and founder of the National Alliance for Women Lawyers. I have to say that Aisha and Sebit, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time.
Thank you.
On Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka. I'm most honored.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Well, I guess I have to come to you immediately because you happen to be very close to me, Aisha.
Absolutely.
You come from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
the most populous nation on the African continent. How widespread or common is this practice of child marriage in Nigeria?
Thank you, Shaka. On record, we have 43%, you know, from researchers. But this happens mostly these days in rural communities, because people in the urban areas have now realized the dangers, you know, involved with marrying out their daughters early. And somehow they tend to send them to school, even though we still have people who end up marrying off their daughters. So we have about a lot of people in the rural areas who go into early marriage, actually, for so many reasons, different reasons.
Talking about so many reasons, what are some of the most common reasons?
First among those reasons are economic reasons. People who often marry off their daughters early tend to say, okay, we don't have enough money to send her to school, and she's a girl, we can't just keep her in the house. And if we marry her off, at least she would be, that would be a burden off the parents. So they marry them off to older men or whoever comes out to seek for their hands in marriage.
The old men who obviously must have deep pockets.
Absolutely, deep pockets. But not in all cases, because when you go down to the rural areas, what do? They are mostly farmers, you know, just little jobs. Little jobs to do. And basically that is all. Something to take the girl off the burden of the family is what they look for. Then for people in the urban areas, they do that to have, you know, sometimes social status. Because when they marry them off to men who are highly placed, you know, the girl tends to have this social fitting in the society. And then the money she makes from the husband, you know, they also benefit from it, because no one would marry, you know, to somebody's daughter and then while the parents live in some abject, you know, situation.
I see.
Yeah.
What about you, Nyon? You come from the Republic of South Sudan, is that correct?
Yes.
How common is this practice of child marriage in South Sudan?
Thank you, Saka, for having me here. South Sudan, like another country in Africa or in like other country in the world, has nothing that is, you know, something exceptional or something that could be said it's not being practiced like by other countries. So it has been, it's a cultural thing. It has been going through for ages before we were born, but it's still going through, you know. So it's a traditional norm. So many countries are, you know, I mean, many communities or all the South Sudanese communities are practicing child marriage. So it is something that has been going through for a very long time. And it's still going through up to now.
So it is a practice that is generally widely accepted in society.
Well, yeah, our society believe it's a part of the cultural practice to marry off young girls. And although the government or the Republic of South Sudan doesn't really encourage girl-child marriage, but still, it is a practice that has been going on in the rural areas and in the communities without the knowledge of, you know, of the government and without also the knowledge of human rights advocates. Or some of the civil society are now advocating so hardly and creating awareness within the communities to ensure that child marriage is eradicated. Of course, South Sudan has laws such as Child Act, which is very, very clear and have put a marriageable age. Children are below the age of 18. And also, South Sudan also have developed and have launched a strategic national action plan to end girl-child marriage by 2030. But still, the practice is going on. It's something that is need a very serious work to do. And, yeah.
You are a lawyer by training.
Yes.
How do you respond to some who say that that type of practice or behavior is an abuse of fundamental human rights of the girl child?
Girl child marriage or child marriage is not just about girl children or about women, but it is actually a violation of fundamental human right of individual, because South Sudan has ratified or is party to so many international instruments such as Convention on the Right of the Child that clearly identify the best interest of the child. And in this sense, it has not been seen as a, you know, as something that need to be respected, because our constitution doesn't also clearly come out and highlight the marriageable age. And South Sudan constitution also have recognized the practice of the our traditional norms and cultures and practice. So I believe it's a work to do. It's not something that will be eradicated overnight.
I think that is needed to be done so as to end that type of practice.
Oh, yeah. Lawyers are working in the country, civil society, women groups, and some institutions such as the Ministry of Gender, they are trying to advocate for ending child marriage and to respect the marriageable age that is that has been legally defined. But it's a very difficult situation because South Sudan is a poor country. Communities are involved, you know, they live in poverty, and girl children are seen by some of the families as the only source of income. There's also high level of illiteracy among the society. So our traditional norm doesn't recognize, you know, young girls being allowed to go to school. And the current conflict also affected, you know, communities in a way that services are not available, such as free education, so that girl children have a certain level of education, or there are no services within the communities. And with the conflict, Sudanese communities and citizens have fled the country, and they're not able to have basic services. So girl children are getting married in either earlier teenage pregnancy or some sort of arranged marriages within their families. So it's a challenge too, yeah. But the advocacy has to continue so that we achieve, you know, the 2030, which I'm not sure we will achieve, because there is a big challenge on that.
I see. Aisha,
yeah.
I'm sure that you've been following your fellow panelists.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask you this question. This is from Honorable Yusuf Fala.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say which country he is writing this email or question from.
Mm-hmm.
He says, what some people view as child marriage, there are others who view it as a fulfillment of some kind of religious command that Islam allows one who can afford it to marry a girl as young as 10.
I wouldn't agree with that, because Islam categorically states that if you eventually, you should marry a girl who has come of age. So because for marriage to take place, she needs some certain level of development, be it mentally, psychologically, and then physically as well, because her body would need to go a lot of, you know, changes when she eventually gets married. She would need to do a lot when she gets married, a lot of thinking, which her mental capacity needs to be up to the level required for that.
Mm.
And a lot of people misquote, you know, the Islamic injunctions on this. You know, the Quran said, yes, you can get married to more than one, but didn't say you should get married to girls.
Does it say to more than one, or does it also say that not more than four?
Not more than four. Mm-hmm. You can get married to two, three, four, That is, if you are able to be just amongst them. And that's a very difficult thing to do. So people who do that, who use that quotation to go ahead to get married to girls as young as 10 or below 10 or a little above 10 before 18, do that based on their own thoughts. Why? Because people who did that way back during the Prophet's time, yes, got married to girls who were young, but they allowed them that space to be children under their roofs, you know, under the care of the senior wives who would serve as their mothers, look after them until they have come of age when they can. And very recently we have somebody from Nigeria, a very prominent person, one of the emirs, one highly placed person, Emir Muhammad Sanusi II, who got married to a girl who just got out of high school.
Is that the smart man who used to be the governor
of
the Nigerian Central Bank?
Absolutely, yes, he was the a former central bank governor. When he got married to this girl when she just went out of high school, he didn't take her in as a wife. She went ahead to study 4 years later on. So if she was 16 when he married her, she would have attained the age of 20. Mm. And if she was 18 when he married her, you know, she will be 22 this year.
But this is obviously a privileged individual, an elite, who has resources, who has a lot of logistics and infrastructure and what have you.
Absolutely.
Someone, obviously, who can afford to be flexible. But what about an ordinary Nigerian man who goes after a very young girl to marry this girl so that she could help in the family, for example?
Well, I don't know what to say, because a lot of people do that. Like I said initially, people marry off their daughters, you know, to be off the hook providing for them. So the financial responsibility of the girl goes off their hands to the man's, to the husband's hands. It doesn't really matter what the man does, especially when you go to rural areas. Let's start with the rural areas. When you go to the rural areas, you find such girls married to common men who do menial works, jobs as little as farming. Some don't just do farming. Some just are laborers. Some are messengers when they come to the cities. But they end up marrying more than one wife. They marry a young girl. So she gets to do a lot of work at home, and she can't go out to work. So for her, she's like married to, I don't know. I don't know. Because she goes through a lot. She doesn't have enough food to eat, you know, and it affects her in so many ways. And when she gives birth to children, she's already a child. How would she take care of another child? What would you do with a child looking after a child? Nothing there. So you end up having child mothers who don't know what to do, who don't know how to take care of their children. And these children also suffer from this.
What about the government? Are there any programs by the government of Nigeria, for example, or state, you know, governments, state authorities, local authorities that can actually be there for the girl child, and indeed even the boy child for that matter, at least to go to school, to be socialized, to acquire some kind of basic skill?
Well, basically, we have the Ministry of Women Affairs, which under that ministry, every issue to do with the girl child is handled, and it depends on each state. And they are doing their best to ensure that there are programs mostly sponsored by not-for-profit organizations, which encourage girl children to go to school.
And these not-for-profit organizations, are they local, domestic, regional, or are they international?
There are local ones, and then there are international ones. And they are doing their best to ensure. Mostly where you have these issues are up north. you know, the Northwest, the Northeast. But for the Northeast, you see, there is very little you can do, especially with the insurgency, you know, because it has eaten so deep. A lot of children don't have anybody, you know, to support them. Lost their parents, both mother and father, relatives, and they don't even know where some of their relatives are. They are displaced.
They don't even know where the next meal will come from.
Yes. So in such a situation, the girls will yield to that. They would definitely yield to that. Because no matter how bad it is, the husband would definitely provide food for her to eat, even if it means just a cloth a year. He would definitely provide something for her.
Do you anybody in particular who has been involved in this type of transaction? Do you know, for example, a young woman who was who got married when they were very, very young?
I do.
Not even reaching the age of menstruation?
Well, not reaching the age of menstruation, that I can't tell. Because, you know, that depends, or it's an individual thing. Some start early, some start late. Some start as early as the age of 12, some 11. So, but I do know somebody who has been into early marriage.
Yes.
Usually it doesn't last. Most times men get married to young girls because they are young. So they just think she's fresh. And then when she gives birth to the first, to the second, he's done with her. And then she's divorced. She's not educated. She lost her childhood. She's a mother, maybe.
She has no security.
No security. She's out on the streets. What does she do?
Very interesting. Nyon, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. I'm here.
Now, Nyon, what do parents generally think in South Sudan about this issue?
Parent, of course, the girl child marriage or the child marriage in South Sudan is most of them are facilitated by parent, the parent of the children, because most of these children, these young girls, they don't have opportunities to engage themselves, such as going to school, such as having a safe space to discuss and identify their priorities and potentials. So the parents are more of the facilitators of girl children's marriage than the protectors of girls from getting married at a very young age.
What about the government? What about the central government? And what about the state and local governments in South Sudan?
Yes, the government is, the Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare is the ministry mandated to oversee issues of women and issues of girl children or of children in general. And I would say is this ministry has been supported by some of the international NGOs and UN agencies, such as UNFPA, UN Women, and other UN agencies, and UNICEF too, to ensure that issues of children are looked into. And last year in 2018, there was a strategic national action plan to implement the ending child marriage by 2030, which was launched. And it was very unfortunate that members of the state governments, where some of them were engaged in practicing child marriage, you know, in a sense that some of the members of the constitutional post holders were even engaged to be part of the competitors in getting married to girl children, which was a little bit very puzzling. And these people, the awareness is going on. The civil society is engaging with this state government. The government, the central government, has not clearly come out and make it a priority at the moment. Although the ministry has, you know, has launched the documents, but the ministry has not come out with a very clear strategy on how they should follow and monitor the implementation strategy. Although civil societies are trying to ensure that this document or this issue of girl child marriage is brought to an end, So there's nothing specific that the government has brought up as a strategy. Although the government have put out the documents, the government has ratified the Convention on the Right of the Child that clearly condemned the girl-child marriage. The government has the Strategic National Action Plan to end child marriage by 2030. There is also a constitution that, you know, say the best interest of the party is getting married and, you know, marriageable age, you know. So there is nothing specific, the program that the government has launched or has put out there to follow the implementation strategy and to ensure that constitutional post holders or members of the government, either in the state or the national level, are not engaged in this practice also. There is also the traditional authorities who are, you know, the leaders at the community levels. There is nothing clear that I have seen that bring both of them and engage with the government at the national or at the state level to talk about this. Big challenge, Saka, is that South Sudan Constitution recognizes the tradition and our practice as people. And child marriage is one of the traditional practice that men who have money, who have wealth, use this provision very clearly, strongly, that our tradition has been recognized by the Constitution. What do you want to tell us? And girl-child marriage is a practice in our society. So there is a, you know, there is a confusion between the laws, the existing law, and also the practice. The level, it is also driven by the level of poverty we have. South Sudanese, majority of us are very poor. And because of that, families look at their girl children as the only option to elevate them from the poverty, especially communities that use cows, cattle for marriage. You know, girls are being married up with 100 cows, with 60 cows, 70 cows, and 20 cows, or 30 cows. Families think that this is the best way to go so that they elevate themselves from the poverty. Educational-wise, too, you know, a good number of South Sudan have the highest rate of illiteracy, of which families or parents or most of the community members are not well informed of the importance of, you know, of girl-child education. And of course, when a girl-child goes to school, it will delay her, you know, it will delay her from getting married at a very young age. And it will also give her a knowledge to understand that, oh, this is, there's a priority than getting married at a very young age. Families that has a very low income too prioritize giving boy children opportunity to go to school than the girl children. So when a girl child remain loitering in the society, she become victims of rapes, she become victims of earlier pregnancy, the teen pregnancy, and she also become victim of the forced marriage, you know. And in this sense, it's a challenge and it's something that need to be addressed and it need to be a priority within the government policies or the government programs.
You know, Nguyen, you attributed, you know, child marriage to the fact that South Sudan is poor. But isn't that poverty in South Sudan really man-made? Because the facts will show, for example, that your country, and I have had the privilege of actually being, you know, moving around your country several times, your country is one of the most fertile countries that I've ever seen. And there are a lot of people who say if there were to be peace and stability, for example, in your country, South Sudan would probably become the breadbasket not only of South Sudan and the region, but perhaps even beyond to the Middle East. You also, of course, have oil, the black gold to boot, and you have other minerals and all that kind of stuff. Don't you really think that this business of being poor is basically artificial and is being caused by probably politicians who have no vision in your country?
That's a very good question, but then you have answered the other part of it, because South Sudan have been in conflict for a very long time, before we became independent 8 years ago. So there had been no security, there had been no protection of civilians and communities to invest in, you know, economic developments, in giving them access to better service delivery. So as I'm speaking to you now, 75% of South Sudanese civilians don't live, or 80%, I'm not sure really, but you are aware, over a million South Sudanese don't live within their country, within the country. So it has given the few South Sudanese living, they don't live in their own ancestral homes. They have moved to, you know, displaced camps where they should look for security. Others live in the protection of civilian side in the UN camp. So in this sense, they are very poor because they don't have opportunity to continue living in their homes and cultivate and rear their cattle like they used to do earlier. So security has blocked all the opportunities too. And it has become very difficult for an ordinary woman, an ordinary man, to continue doing their activities without fear of being killed or being, you know. So it's very difficult to answer that. But the thing is, South Sudan is in war. That is the only thing I could say. But before conflict too, there has been this practice of child marriage. It is a custom. So I don't think, even if South Sudan get into a total peace, sustainable, which is a priority, and this is what most of us are earning for, you know, asking the parties to ensure that there's a total peace in the country, there will still be challenge of our traditional practices. And our traditional practices value the wealth of cows, value the wealth of, you know, of bride price. So these communities will continue to marry off their children, or the conversation around families, because the thing is, as girl children in Africa or in South Sudan, we grow up being surrounded by our female relatives telling us even that marriage is good. The whole discussion is about marriage. So as a young girl, you have to behave a certain age, you know, when you reach 14, you reach 13, you know, people look at you as, you know, something to be married off. That is the only thing girl children grow up knowing. So there is also that tendency of breaking the cycle and the stereotype that girl children are not only there to get married. Education is very important, because I was also raised in during the conflict of the Sudan and the South Sudan during the movement. And I have seen families where women have a little education, and even some of the families where men were killed during the conflict, women who were, you know, who were educated, who have a certain level of education, they raised their family and they raised their children very, very well. So the issue of girl-child education or ending child marriage is not about her personal development, which is important, but also contributed to the development of the society, and it also contributed to the development of the country. So it's not like girls need to go to school, get degree, do the, you know, make money, and that's not. They also raise families. They also contribute to the development of the country, to the development of the community and the society. So there is a need to ensure that we work collectively, the government, the traditional authority, the religious leaders, and we too, the civil society, the activists, the women group. So it's a challenge. It's a total challenge, but I believe we will go there.
Well, Nyon, I think well said. In fact, studies show that the more or the better the woman is educated, the more income, of course, she earns, and the more power she will be having, not only to provide a health and good lifestyle of her family, but also her relatives and her community. Now, having said this, Nyon, do you realistically think that from what you have been able to see and the steps that governments are taking, you expect to see the end of practices such as girl child marriage in your lifetime?
Well, yeah, I am really longing because I have friends and I have some of the relatives who got married at a very young age. And I have friends who also have some of their close relatives who are married at a very young age and their life is really difficult and you could see the suffering. The thing is, violence that you hear women are experiencing in their marriage, the domestic violence is also generated from issues of child marriage or earlier marriages or issues of poverty. And when a woman is educated, there is always a contribution within the families. You know, within the family, the male and the husband and the wife will contribute financially equally. They will be able to raise their children equally. And this will also eliminate violence against each other or against women. Health-wise, too, when a girl child is married at a very young age, it has impact on her health, you know, status and issues of during giving birth to child and, you know. So it is another challenge. But then a society where women are educated is not just about earning their financial independence, but it is about also contributing to the policies of the government, to the policies that bring development to the country. And I believe women are really great agents of change because I have seen a number of women who have been very vocal in their communities and have been able to provide, you know, creating an environment where communities peacefully coexist. So when women are given a chance to go to school, especially young girls, to grow up dreaming, you know, and achieve their dreams, it will definitely create a space for a country as a general, a community as in particular, or a family to really live in a better life. Because it's not about how women and men should be equal, but it is how we should work together as women and men to move up. If the African Union Agenda 2063 need to be achieved, women education or ending child marriage have to be mainstream and implemented by the governments so that we become parties to the development of the country. And I think, yeah, it's not going to be said, oh, this is our norm, this is our culture, this is this and this. It needs to be a priority. It's not just a program that needs to be involved in the government policies or in a country plan, work plan and all. It has to be a priority that a country put forward, country like my country, South Sudan, have to put this forward.
I hear you.
Yes.
I hear you, Nyonda. Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa, and we'll have more of a discussion in a moment. So please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Sister Gizriu Uwat, and we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can watch our show there and leave a comment. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Historically, black colleges and universities in the United States have educated generations of African Americans. HBCUs have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are talking about child marriage, and our guests are Aisha Mwazu, a reporter with VOA's Hausa Service, and from New York, we are joined by Nyon Susan Sebit, founder of the National Alliance for Women Lawyers. Well, I have to say again that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time. Let me come to you immediately, Aisha. You heard, of course, Nyon made a very, very strong case, and especially the case of education. You know, there was a great Ghanaian pioneer educator by the name Kwejiri Agre. And sometimes, in fact, he's referred to as Kwejiri Agre of Achimota. He never really started that school. A great, great school, by the way, in Ghana. It has almost taught anybody that has ever become president of the Republic of Ghana, except for a few people, including the incumbent president, Nana Akufo-Addo, who happens to have gone to St. Augustine in Cape Coast. He was, though, Kwejiri Agre, the vice principal or the deputy principal of Achimota College during the colonial period, because he was an incredible, incredible educator. He was also a very, very strong promoter of women's education. In fact, he once said that if you educate a man, you end up with an individual.
Absolutely.
But when you educate a girl, you educate a woman, you in fact end up with not only a village or a neighborhood, but in fact a nation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's correct.
You agree with him?
I do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'll share with you, I know a lady who went to school, you know, she didn't quite get married early. Back in Nigeria, up north, it's a shameful thing not to be married off before you're 30. But she didn't get married until after 30. So during that wait period, she went to school, acquired a degree before she got married. She had another sister who was almost her age, you know, because of polygamy. They almost the mothers almost gave birth to them at the same time. But the other lady who got married, you know, off after high school was a little older than her. So this educated lady ensured that every other child in the family went to school. She did all she could to support them to go to school. And likewise, that other sister of hers that didn't go to school ended up going back to school. She's presently in school. What am I saying? We attach a lot of importance to educating the male child in Africa. Let me speak about Nigeria. We do that a lot.
Because of culture.
Because of culture.
And guess who controls the culture?
Who? So, the men do.
Yes.
So, when we attach a lot of importance to educating men only, we end up losing a lot to that. Why? When you educate a woman, after school, she thinks of getting married. When she gets married, she acquires a job. When she acquires a job, she's married, she's working. Her husband takes care of her, and she earns money as well. So she has a little more than the man. Sometimes she even earns more than the man.
Right.
So parents are beginning to be aware of the fact that it is also important to, you know, educate the girl child. In fact, some of them place more importance to the girls these days.
than the boys.
Than the boys. It's a gradual process. I believe that
it should be equal. Yeah. It should be education should be an equal opportunity employer. It should not discriminate in favor of this gender or against the other gender.
But what can you do when you have men after school, they get married, and then they have a they start a family, they have to take care of their families. So no matter what they earn, no matter how much they earn at the end of each month, they will have to split that within their own family, which is a primary responsibility. You know, their wife is their primary responsibility and their parents.
Well, I have to say that time again is not, of course, my best ally here. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. We have on the line Lawrence from Sierra Leone. Good evening, Lawrence. You are most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Yeah, good evening.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good, and I'm following the program, and I'm following up on the discussions, and we're learning from our experiences in other countries.
And Lawrence, you're only doing good, not doing huge and terrific like me.
Pardon me, come again, please.
You are simply doing good, not huge and terrific like me.
I did not get it clear.
I see. What is your question, Lawrence?
Yes, it's sort of a question that it's rather what can we do, especially as Africans, and how can we actually synergize our efforts to actually put an end to child marriage in Africa? What can the AU do? Because I remember some time back again, the African Union tried to reinforce that commitment to actually put an end to child marriage by actually launching an agenda, a program that comes with huge financial support to African countries where child marriage, where there is a high prevalence of child marriage. In Sierra Leone, my country, of course, there is a high prevalence of child marriage, and it's related to different factors, I can say, and you have the several consequences again on the welfare and well-being and development of children in Sierra Leone.
Very interesting. I'm sure you were listening to Lawrence, is asking what can the African Union do. Well, people forget, by the way, that the African Union is not an institution that has sovereign powers. This particular issue, if it has to be dealt with, it seems to me that it really has to begin right at home.
Absolutely.
Right with the local state where there are states, and really right with government authorities.
True.
You know, there is a case, for example, where not child marriage in particular, but this issue of education, women education. We are talking about the city-state of Singapore. There was a man called Lee Kuan Yew, who was prime minister for 31 good years. And he has the distinction of having, in fact, lifted Singapore from a third world, poor, developing country to a first world, developed country. He did it in 31 years. When you go around the world, you go to London and you're at Heathrow, you see these huge 747 Boeing, Singapore Airlines, and what have you. And this is a man, contrary to what people say about Africa, how Africa has different, ethnic communities and what have you, and therefore that probably isn't very easy to negotiate around that and actually develop. Singapore had three different ethnic communities, if you will. It had the Malay, who were the majority and were the poorest. And their girls were not going to school because of this thing called culture. You had the Chinese minority. And Lee Kuan Yew was a Chinese whose father had two Rollies. That's how we ended up going to school, ending up in Cambridge University Law School, and coming back and fighting for independence and becoming the Prime Minister, the first Prime Minister of Singapore. Then you had the Indians who were into trade and what have you and stuff like that, and their girls went to school. But Lee Kuan Yew realized that you could not possibly develop a nation without involving everybody. And so what he did was to figure out a way of going to persuade the parents of the Maori community mm-hmm. that education was not something that really you didn't have to think about. You had to have your girls educated mm-hmm. because it was the right thing to do. And that is the only way you could, you know, help him, he said, so that he in turn could help develop the nation for everybody. And this is how Singapore became Singapore. Why can't our governments, for example, mm-hmm. the government of Nigeria, for example, I mean, your president, for example, General Muhammadu Buhari, is retired. Doing a very good job, retired but not tired. Mm-hmm. He's doing a good job in the sense that he's fighting corruption. The results are, you know, here and there, but he's at least, he has said, they say, there's a saying that even a journey of 1,000 miles, the first step is the single most important part. Mm-hmm. Why can't he, for example, say, from today, every girl child in Nigeria has the right, not a privilege, to access education?
Well, I think in Nigeria...
And work with the parents.
With the parents?
Yeah.
In Nigeria, education is open to all. Mm. It only depends on the parents.
You have universal
basic education,
primary education, mm-hmm. and does it in fact have the accompanying logistics and infrastructure and what have you, or is it simply on paper?
We have what we have.
Do the ministers and the senior government authorities actually have their children go to those schools?
No.
Well, where do they go?
Basically, they take their children outside.
And why don't they go to those schools if in fact they are schools?
Because they are not good. I think that's like you
they
said.
They are not good for who?
Well, for those who can't afford to take their children outside. That's the poor man.
But they say that
the
power belongs to,
the people.
And therefore, the people should be the ones, in fact, whose children go to choice schools, not these people who are supposed to be their employees.
Shaka, I'm with you on this. I believe if there's one thing we need to address in Nigeria, it's the issue of education. The educational sector in Nigeria is so backward, it's in such a mess, and it needs a total overhaul. Mm. Reason being that, you see, most of these public office holders, you know, have the wherewithal to sponsor their wards and children to go outside the country to study, get a good education, and then come back.
Right.
To me, I believe they come back and then the next generation would be those children ruling over the children of the poor.
Of the poor.
Again. Mm. If we need to move forward, you know, move the educational sector forward, we need to have every public office holder send his child to all those schools.
Precisely. As a matter of fact, Aisha, I have news for you. My generation, when we were going to school, we were going to the same schools with the children of the elite.
Absolutely. That's
because true. Those schools had value. But from what I read today, I come from Uganda in East Africa. The children of the elite do not go
to those schools,
quote-unquote, universal primary schools.
Times have changed.
It is the ordinary folks who go there and sit under the tree. And of course, at the end
not
of the day,
schools.
They are taken through educational real emotions. They go through motions, really. They do not study anything.
That's
that
true.
Eventually will result into a skill that they can exchange for their livelihood.
Shaka, the issue
but
of
the children of the
in
authorities,
Nigeria.
Guess where they go? They are here, in North America.
In Nigeria, Shaka, the issue of education is a topic for another day. You can't discuss that on this
Good.
You know, 1 hour show or together right. with this other issue.
We'll have it an additional you know,
but
I
believe that if the government would look into that, if public office holders would send their children to, you know, government-owned schools,
right.
I believe that every public office holder would do all within their power to ensure that those schools are up to standard.
Precisely. So our hospitals, for example, hospitals, where I come from and a lot of African countries, government senior government authorities actually go to Europe. They go to India.
For medical.
They go to South Africa. They come here for medical checkup. But guess what happens to the ordinary folks? They have nowhere to go. The hospitals have no drugs, they have no medicine. And these guys, the elite, when they go to places like South Africa, they go to the United Kingdom and they come here, guess who is their doctor? Nigeria. The doctors who come from their neighborhood.
Yeah, that's true. I think, Shaka, if we really want to address the issue of girl-child marriage, you see, back in Nigeria and northern Nigeria precisely, working with the traditional leaders and to some extent the religious leaders, because in Nigeria religion is something we hold. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Bring them
working
on board.
With them.
Show them
bring
that
them
it is in their interest.
Yes.
It is in everybody's interest.
So the people
for
listen.
For their girls to actually be socialized, get an opportunity to get an education. So that they can actually make choices. And make informed decisions about their lives, their families, their communities, and therefore their nation.
Those community leaders, to some extent, are informed. They also have their children in school.
Correct.
But, you know, it's in categories. There are categories. There are some in the rural areas, but notwithstanding, they still send their daughters to school.
Right, right.
So working with them would help, would, you know, will go a long way in ensuring that the people actually accept this. It's very difficult to accept change.
I hear it.
So, but when
and
you
yet,
go through
and yet,
this,
let's face it, nothing endures except change. You have to learn the changes that must necessary, how to handle or manage the changes that must necessarily occur. Because guess what? Society is not static. It is dynamic. And so are these cultures that we are talking about.
To some extent, people are beginning to move. It's a gradual process, but a lot more needs to be done.
It is a process.
Yeah, it's a process. I believe that someday we'll get there, because right now, as it is, we have a lot of women in different sectors doing so wonderfully well. We have women in IT, we have women in engineering, we have women doing wonderfully well, and I think if what these girls need are role models.
Role models.
If they have role models who would actually put them through, see that, yes, this lady was from my village,
Aisha,
and she has...
You and Nyon can actually be perfect role models for the young girls in your respective countries.
Absolutely, that's very true.
Go
that's
for
true.
It. Well,
thank you.
Well, on that note, our distinguished guests are Aisha Mwazu and Nyon Susan Sebit. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.